So Tasha, you were at the event, at the Robotaxi event. You got to see a bunch of robots up close. I think the experience from an outsider view versus an insider view, the more I talk to people that have gone there, is very different, because we, for us that were sort of watching from afar, it felt like there wasn't a lot of detail. It felt like some of the things that we wanted to hear about wasn't there. And I'm sure that's also potentially true when you're there. But I feel like the vision maybe was clearer when you actually got to play with the freaking robots in person and actually take a ride in the cyber cab and whatnot. So maybe start by giving us a high level overview of what you saw, and then we'll get into the nitty gritty here. So I'll give you the mic.
Yeah. So I went to the event with Kathy and Brett from ARC. Kathy and I rode in a cyber cab following the speech. And then we also rode in Model Y later on, no one in the driver's seat. So, you know, first I'll say, like, this is like a closed circuit. So it's the Warner Brothers studio lot. This is not a public road. That said, there were still like pedestrians. There were other cars there. So there were obstacles. So easier to solve than public roads, integrated traffic, but like the thing still works, right? So, you know, CyberCab has no steering wheel and pedals, as we all know, successfully drove us around particular points. It was like, you select a, it was a point to point, specific system again. So this is not the solution I expect them to roll out, in the network. Eventually, I expect it to be working like Uber. But this is what they demoed. And I think it's not nothing that they were able to do this on what is essentially a prototype car, right? That they just made. I mean, they had 20 of them. They put the software on and it works. And I'd agree with you that I think that being there, you know, something Kathy and I have been talking about is seeing and meeting members of the FSD team, of the engineering team, the design team, at Tesla, and just like sensing the excitement that they felt in Tesla's mission and how eager they were to see our feedback on, you know, the new products and what they're launching. You really feel like they felt like they've accomplished something. And, you know, I'll also point out there was that, Tesla AI tweet that talked about their goals for, you know, the next 6+ months. And they essentially achieved everything they said they would in September. It just wasn't highlighted at the event. So that's not nothing. So I think that people kind of expected, even though there wasn't necessarily less information, I felt, than previous product launches, people were expecting something that was like a hybrid between a product launch and an investor day, just because, you know, robotaxis invite a lot of questions, and this is a software plus a hardware problem, right? So, you know, you need a lot to work in order to make this happen. And Tesla just chose to keep a little bit more close to its chest, and which is, you know, they still show us a lot more than Waymo does. So I will say that. But yeah, in general, they're a little bit more measured in their comments, which is, I think, the reaction that we saw.
Got it. What was one of the things that stood out to me that you mentioned is, you know, it's still, even though it's a prototype car and even though it's a closed course and you can only go to like 3 different places, the environment was still filled with a lot of different complexity. There were pedestrians moving around. Like there were, I think, 2,500 people, right? And they let these things loose without a steering wheel and pedal to navigate the course with people. So to me, that feels like, okay, they're comfortable with the liability of having these things operate even in a very close circuit, right? Did you feel the same way when you were there? Did it really feel as hectic as it seemed, where just people just kind of could cross the road whenever they want and the cars would react? Can you describe that a little bit better?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. So of course, like, there are Tesla personnel kind of ushering people into the cars, being there when you come out. You know, the one thing that they said to us was like, they wanted us to be mindful of the doors. And I feel like that's because it is a new door design. You know, maybe they're still tweaking that, or, you know, we know everything that happened with the Falcon wing door. So maybe the Butterfly, you know, but overall, like, I never felt unsafe. And you're absolutely right that anyone from the event could have just like stumbled into the street. And I think that I didn't hear of any accidents or any sort of complaints there. So, you know, it felt overall, like, from a safety perspective, like, again, it works for the purpose that they laid it out for at that time.
And yes, they were able to, you know, surreptitiously slip the dead bodies away. So.
That's right. Hans or Larry, before I make this podcast greedily for my own sake, go ahead and jump in.
So Hans, why don't you go ahead? Yeah.
The only question I had on that topic was just, what was the top speed that you observed that the vehicle seemed to travel, or was there any indication of speed in the vehicle?
Well, that's a very good question. So I didn't directly. Okay. So I think in the cyber cab, there was nothing to directly observe it. And I actually asked them about this. So there was like an infotainment screen and you could watch like some movie kind of clips and some like Tesla clips as well about the cyber cab itself. But there were, you know, when you get in a Waymo car, it shows you the visuals. And when you drive Tesla and FSD, as we all know, there are also visuals of what's happening around you and what the car is observing. There was none of that. And there was actually just no other sort of information about what the car was doing either. So I think that they'll add that later. I got the sense from talking with them. But so I didn't see the cyber cab. I didn't see it in, we were in the Model Y and I didn't look. I don't know if we could have, I assume we could have. I didn't see it, but it was a very slow speed. So it was definitely below 30 miles per hour. It could have been like 10, but that is the rough average speed of New York City driving 11 miles per hour. So in dense urban centers, you're actually not going that fast anyways. So doesn't surprise me. I mean, that's like the safer way to go. Above 30, your chances of killing someone just, you know, skyrocket compared to below 30 for pedestrians. So, you know, I guess like from what I see in the FSD behavior, and like, I'd love to get your thoughts on this, Larry, I'm not that concerned about Tesla being like, you know, overly conservative on this. Like we know that they have designed a system that like when it has to be aggressive, it is. And I feel like that's actually a lot of the improvement that I've noticed in the 12.5 software release is that in New York City traffic, it's become like usable in situations where I didn't really want to use it previously for that reason.
Yeah, 12.5.5 is extraordinary. I just drove to Boca Chica to the launch site from North Carolina, about 1,500 miles on FSD all the way. The quality of the software is really extraordinary at this point. I think they're very, very close. I think probably close enough that the next version is going to be usable. I'm interested, was there any means of intervention at all in the drive? You know, if you'd got stuck or if something had happened during the drive?
Yeah, there is actually one thing that happened. I think that it happened. So we picked a drop-off point and it seemed like the car got to that point, kept on going, and then did another loop around, which I wasn't quite sure why it had to do that. I feel like it could have stopped. I'm not exactly, I mean, nothing was unsafe. It added maybe an extra minute, so it wasn't a big deal. But there was like an end drive button, which I did press kind of by the time we got to the location for the second time, just to make sure that, you know, we could hop out. But, you know, so I did use it and it seemed kind of seamless other than that one extra loop.
Yeah. 12.5.5 often takes me to the front door of the hotel and then drives around the parking lot again. So I think that's, you know, that they haven't figured out. I guess that'll come once ASS is integrated into the stack. You know, I think the whole parking and integration of the ASS into the stack is the next step. And I'd love to see that happen.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
How does the event, has that changed your timelines for how you're thinking about the rollout of this? This program, the cadence, sort of how it's impacting the current fleet. The big thing that I saw come out of the event afterwards, Kim Java, who's a great channel for those that want to check her out. She covers the EV space very closely. Shout out Kim and her husband, who's also Persian. Shout out. one of the things that they said Lars and Franz was that the Hardware 3 cars. I mean, what I heard was that conclusively they would be able to do robotaxi, which mm-hmm. means that one of the sort of overhangs that I've been tracking, which I think long-term wouldn't be a huge deal, but it could cause a lot of friction in the short term, was that the Hardware 3 cars were either incapable of being to operate as robotaxis, or they would need a significant upgrade. But it sounds like they are, at the very worst, a minimal upgrade away, which is something that Hans and I have been debating. And he kept telling me, no, they just need, at the worst, a small upgrade, right? How has that changed your thesis at all? Yeah, help us understand that.
Yeah, I think In terms of our thesis, so previously we had estimated that they could launch a robo-taxi service in 2025 or 2026. And it's roughly like a 60-40 probability that we had set for those as the launch years in our 2029 valuation price target, which we publish online. So they said at the event, so Elon had previously said that they could launch unsupervised FSD. And it is a slight distinction, right? They're talking about it in terms of the unsupervised FSD launch. They have not specified robotaxi network launch date yet. That's just what we believe. So previously it said that that unsupervised could happen. So hands off the wheel could happen as soon as the end of this year. But he definitely thought by next year. He said something along those lines. And then at the event, of course, he said, it looks like it's next year. So it's like firmly pushed into that. So that's a little bit more measured than what we've heard in the past. You know, there's been a lot of like, I think confusion over the low cost vehicle, cyber cab, and kind of how those relate. But overall, like if you go back to the first comments they've made about it, the production date for that also seems to be a little pushed out. But like in Tesla's history, I'm not that surprised to hear things get shifted around 6 months to a year. I think they set really aggressive targets strategically in order to achieve really hard things. So I still think that once they launch unsupervised FSD, it's only a matter of time for them to launch a robotaxi service. But I do get the sense that they are still working out pieces of the back end operationally about how that would work. I think that it could be a strategic choice to keep more to their chest. We know that everyone in China is trying to copy what they do, related to FSD and potentially other companies in the US. But I think there's a possibility that they're still working that out because they've just been so focused on full autonomy. And then lastly, your point on Hardware 3, I agree. I think Hardware 3 vehicles will be included in the unsupervised launch, even though there was like, I know some thoughts about that at the event. Someone yelled it out and Elon didn't want to get into it. But that's my impression, especially now with the end-to-end system. I think that makes it easier to transfer to those vehicles.
Yeah. What are some of the things that you gathered in your conversations that you can share after sort of after the event was done? You mentioned that, you know, you spoke to, did you speak to any Tesla folks while you were there? Did you gather any additional context? Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we spoke to a lot of people. So actually Phil from the FSD team is who met. I actually asked him this very question, like what gives you the confidence? Because previously it sounded like they were running two models, one for Hardware 3 and 4. And then, but in the, I believe it was in the AI tweet, they said that they were turning that into just one model for both of them. And I asked him what gave him the confidence and he said it was the end-to-end system. So that, you know, confirmation on that. In general, I think that again, like our biggest takeaway, other than asking more details about the Cybercab, which I also think that they made, you know, they had 20 of those cars. It's possible that there's still tweaks that they're making to them, definitely, based on our conversations. I mentioned the infotainment piece, but I think, you know, I wouldn't expect any major design changes, but I think that it's possible that they're tweaking that still before, you know, that actually, again, before it goes into production. But other than that, it was really just like the excitement from the team. And you could really tell like how much they liked working there. And they were so excited to see everyone's reaction. And I feel like just having them all at the event and sort of highlighting them in that way is like a good move on Tesla to kind of reward those employees with the progress they've made.
How finished did those prototypes feel? Because when I view the event from far away, you know, usually when you sort of in Tesla's history, when they've shown a car for the first time, it's usually a very obvious prototype design. It's usually lacking the details. It's lacking like the camera, it's lacking the grill and sort of, you know, like the vents and the intakes and the interior is very Spartan. And the one thing that I realized with this robotaxi is if you kind of look at the exterior, it, you know, outside of painting the tire, which is like hilarious, you know, like to try and make the sort of rim look much bigger than it actually is. They have the full sensor suite. The front looks like it has an air intake. The when they were opening the doors and they were opening the trunk, it had all the trim, you know, it had it looked like it was a car that wasn't necessarily a prototype, but maybe, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, it would look more like an alpha manufacturing prototype design. Like they moved past the prototype stage and now they're into the manufacturing stage, and this was like their first ones off the line. Can you confirm that, deny that, provide more context?
I think that's a pretty good read. It didn't feel like a prototype. It felt like a finished car. I just get the sense, again, that there's like possible design elements that they could tweak. And in terms of the sensor set layout, I actually didn't see it live, but then I later saw photos online of the front bumper camera that they added that's not on other vehicles. So that was a rumor that, of course, that looks like it's true that they added that as an extra sensor. So I wouldn't expect it to change too much. And in fact, the fact that they're saying that they can do hardware 3 and hardware 4 cars means that, like, in some sense, like, it can't change too much if that's their plan. Or at least, I imagine that it's easier for it to be backwards compatible when it looks very similar on sort of the latest generation vehicle. It felt like a finished car. So I wouldn't expect major, maybe even not like noticeable tweaks here. I think that's a good read.
But the front bumper camera is on the Cybertruck as well, right?
Yes.
I believe so. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's probably coming. I just want to make one comment on the issue of hardware 3 versus hardware 4. The reason for the delay in the hardware 3 is that some of the functions that are built into some of the software functions that are built into hardware in hardware 4 have to be executed by way of software in hardware 3. What they have done now is they have moved that software into a function that is now built into the core compilation. So there's not going to be any time differential now between the two releases, or there shouldn't be. And that time differential is going to go away. So the only real value of having hardware 4 over hardware 3 is that some of the functions that are executed in hardware hardware 4 are going to be executed in software in hardware 3. But other than that, there's not going to be any difference between the two processes. And this kind of change will continue into hardware 5. And I've given that on very reliable sourcing. So just wanted to mention that.
Could I ask you to elaborate on that when you say hardware versus software?
Yeah, so there are some software functions which they discovered are used with, so frequently and so in such a standard way that they decided or they elected to implement those programmatic features into hardware, into the actual chip itself. The way they solve for that when it's not in the chip is that they have that in software. And what they've done is they built that into the actual, function of the software. So now they have a means to execute that same code that is executed on the processor. They execute that in software. It's a fairly consistent way to approach that kind of problem. And I think that it's going to be, a problem that's going to go away. And those folk who were raising this business about, oh, your hardware 3 cars are useless. So they're the same people who raise all this nonsense around Tesla and around this software, around every aspect of the car. So I would ignore it entirely.
Yeah, I mean, there's enough hardware 3 vehicles. It's like, it's not quite 50-50, but it's like close to 50-50 hardware 3 and 4 right now. So it's like 6 million cars globally. They're so incentivized to make it work. I'd be surprised if they didn't. So,
and in a year's time, it'll be hardware 5 that will be standard. And so hardware 5, I don't know if hardware 5, but certainly by hardware 6, is going to be a very significant expansion of the inference capability, because Elon has this idea of inference being, a function that they can use commercially, that they can, to
distribute
inference that they can turn into a business. So that's coming for sure. I mean, that's certainly for sure. And it may actually switch off during travel to reduce consumption. power consumption. So there's going to be kind of two modes of power consumption. So that's what I'm thinking in terms of design. But that's coming for sure. I don't think it's going to be in Hardware 5 because I think Hardware 5 is a done deal already.
Yeah, I think the thing that had me confused about the Hardware 3 and 4, sort of like if Hardware 3 is going to be able to do Robotaxi, was Elon has been so vague on it. Even in the event, he was vague about it. You know, when he mentioned that somebody was shouting out, Hardware 3, Hardware 3, he's like, let's not get into the nuance, right? Let's not get into the detail. And initially, I read that as, okay, he doesn't want to confirm it because it's unlikely for that to happen. And then Kim's interview with Lars and Franz confirmed that Hardware 3 can do it. So I think the vagueness was more can be attributed more to trying to prevent the current Hardware 3 owners from upgrading their cars. Like he didn't want to add another sort of layer that says, no, keep your car, don't upgrade to Hardware 4, because they want to keep those lines pumping, right? So sort of my thing has shifted from Hardware 3 is probably not going to do it to, okay, he wants to sell cars. So he doesn't want people to not upgrade their cars because they're afraid it's not going to have FSD. So that's one thing that jumped out to me after this discussion and after that interview. Go ahead, Tasha. So you're off mute.
Yeah, I feel like I wouldn't be surprised if they're reserving kind of the right to launch first on Hardware 4, but that doesn't mean that they won't launch on Hardware 3. That's my guess about why he didn't want to get into the details. But yeah, I don't know. Larry, if you have thoughts.
I don't believe there'll be a difference in timing at all. I think now that they have built the Hardware 4 functions into the compilation, as it were, the compilation mode, I don't think it's going to be any difference at all. I think we're going to see a much faster release of versions than we've seen in the past and different hardware configurations. I think that's going to collapse. What's interesting to me is that the confidence which they announced the releases up to 10.10, you know, the team itself released what they expected to be available and when, and they hit every mark just about. And so my guess is that they are already testing the next version, and that the next version, the release, the rhythm of the release is going to be much faster and much smoother. That's my guess.
Okay. I want to hit this point, and then I also want to talk about Bot and the van as well. The Bot especially, because the Bot, I think, anyway, I'll save my question. I'm getting carried away already. So the intuition around the Robotaxi being much closer to a finished alpha prototype for manufacturing versus a prototype. I think that what's interesting there is if the guidance at the event was, hey, at the latest, it'll be before 2027, so late 2026 for this thing to go into production and go, right? That seems like a really long timeline. If you think about Tesla's previous cadence of like alpha prototype for manufacturing to launch, it's about 6 to 9 months traditionally that it takes, even with the Cybertruck. If you saw sort of like the alpha prototype designs to when they launched the first foundation series, it was about 8 to 9 months, if I'm not correct. It was definitely less than a year, and it was more than 6 months. It was somewhere in that window. So if they have something like this already out, you know, they have 20 of them rolling off the line somewhere, and then, you know, they're testing them or whatever, but it's pretty near a finalized manufacturing design. To me, it sort of implies that this car, and this is sort of, this was a debate we were talking about this on the last podcast we made last week, Hans and I. To me, this feels like the compact car. To me, this CyberCab feels like the compact car, because if they were talking about cheaper, more affordable models in the quarterly earnings report, and they have a manufacturing line that is already creating a form factor that would fit that profile, that would also not cannibalize Model 3 and Model Y too much, because it's a two-seater, and it's, you know, my guess is it's going to be low power. I mean, look at the seats. The seats have zero like side support. These things are just couches, right? So this thing can't go any faster than, you know, 0 to 60 in 8 seconds, because you'll just, you know, you'll be thrown around the car if those are the final seats, right? So to me, it feels like this is a under wraps launch of the compact car without calling it the compact car. And the other variable as well is getting the CyberCab production to marry the jurisdiction approval when your plan is to make millions of units per year of this thing potentially seems like a nightmare, because you'll be throwing all this money into CapEx and building out the lines, but then you can't really crank out cars until somebody gives you the green light to say, yeah, you can manufacture those, right? And then if you think about the cadence of jurisdictions approving these things, at the most, if you just kind of look at how government has traditionally acted with giving approval and the fact that Tesla's going to have to provide a lot of data and the fact that you have jurisdictions in Europe that are not going to allow this for a long time, you know, China might be a lot easier. It feels like there isn't that much production out there to satisfy the demand for this product. And if they were to release a cheaper vehicle, that would be a completely different line potentially from this one. So it's like, to me, it feels like this is the compact car. Did you have any thoughts there, Tasha? Like, this is the car they're going to release in the first half of next year, but with a steering wheel and pedal.
I do think that there's a lot of overlap between what they've announced for the low-cost car and the CyberCab. And like, in a way, there should be, right? I mean, that would kind of be the most efficient way to do things. And why the CyberCab should be your lowest cost car of the lineup, because that would make sense just from a low price to the consumer for like cost per mile perspective for them. So I do think that, and again, the way that they've talked about it, we talk about it internally, like, has been a little confusing because of that overlap. So I definitely think that they could have a lot in common, and, you know, they did work. It's sub $30,000. I guess they said it's not the unboxed method. So if they were to implement that, you know, I imagine there'd be even more cost savings. But I think your point about regulation is interesting. I think during the event, Elon, you know, previously when they were asked about regulation, the answer was always, well, okay, we're in very close contact with regulators like NHTSA. You know, this isn't foreign to us, and we don't expect it to be like this massive hurdle. And I still feel like that's certainly what I believe. I think the technical problem is tougher than the regulatory problem. But he appeared to mention regulators in a way that I felt like he hadn't quite said before. You know, when he talked about the robotaxi launch, he mentioned more than once, you know, a pending regulation. And you can imagine how a regulator wouldn't be happy hearing Tesla agree to some firm deadline of when they were going to do something before they've even made a filing to get approval. So I think that that's actually smart to message it that way. And it makes me feel like they're actually closer to that finish line if now those considerations are coming into play. But it is state to state right now. So, you know, California is probably a more complicated regulatory environment than Texas. So I think like the speed at which those go could kind of depend state to state. But yeah, I don't think it's a huge problem, but I do think that they seem closer to it than before. And the way that they're talking about it is slightly different than before.
Larry or Hans, any last words on robotaxi before we hit van or bot?
I mean, my sense is that the cost form factor will change for the compact car. I don't know if you've seen how huge that trunk is on that car. So I think it actually has the capacity for a four-seater hatchback. And I think that's what we'll see in the compact car on the same form factor, using a lot of the same, exactly to your point, Fawzad. So I think I'm going to be slightly modified in terms of what you're saying. So I think it'll be a more car-like car, but on the same, basically the same production line, the same form factor, using a lot of the same components. I don't think the same doors.
Yeah, that pretty much marries up exactly with my thinking on this at this point in time. And I know that they've said that, you know, there's not going to be a CyberCab with steering wheel and pedals. And I think that's a piece of semantics that people don't recognize. Like, of course, if it's a CyberCab, then it doesn't have a steering wheel and pedals. But I think that to Larry's point, we have to have a lot of production in between here and there. Like, you know, eventually, if you just think about the end state and then you think about today, in the end state, robotaxis are legal everywhere and demand is essentially unlimited. and you need to crank them out as fast as humanly possible. And then the way that, you know, Lars and Franz talked about, the question that Kim asked them was, you know, is this the robo-taxi or is this the cyber cab? And they said, well, this is the cyber cab. All Teslas are robo-taxis. This specific model is the cyber cab. And so with that in mind, you know, we only have a supply chain right now that can support 2 million-ish vehicles a year. And then, you know, if by the end of next year, it can support 3 million, well, that's still a far cry from the amount of demand that there will be for Cybercab just alone by itself, much less Cybercab and all the other Tesla robotaxis combined. And so we really have to grow that supply chain and that production capacity. And you don't grow supply chain and production capacity stepwise. You grow it like continuously and incrementally. And so we have to have, and this is why they've talked about, you know, the fact that there will be new models that are produced on current lines will expand our capacity to that 3 million unit run rate. And I think that the car that Larry described is the obvious form factor, that it's something that's probably a smaller version of the Model Y that shares a tremendous amount of common parts with that eventual Cybercab form factor. So, you know, it's going to have the same steer-by-wire system and the same battery and the same castings. But then, since it's not actually a cyber cab, maybe you do actually want four seats. And you, to Larry's point, the doors, you know, you don't want a two-door four-seater, probably. You probably want something that's a little bit more sensible. Unless they were going to do something strange, like I wouldn't expect this, but I have thought that there is a possibility that they could do a four-seater that has jump seats in the back, and the back is just a hatch. So it could be a two-door hatch with jump seats instead of four seats all facing forward.
Like a two-door Civic or something from like back in the 90s.
Well, and I mean, that's what they did with the seven-seat Model S back in the day. So it's not something they're completely unexperienced with or opposed to. So that would be one way to actually maintain, although in that scenario, I still don't think that you would have the butterfly doors. Like, the only reason you need the butterfly doors is because there are no human drivers in the car at points in time where it's important to be able to open and close the doors. And so I don't think you go to the complexity of doing those complicated, you know, cyber cab butterfly doors if you don't have to, because it is definitely more complicated, more costly, more difficult. Unless, to argue against myself, you really want to ramp up the supply chain for those components beforehand.
Tasha, I saw you came off mute earlier. Did you want to throw something in?
No, I think those are all really great points. And I agree with you that there's like clear advantages to doing the door specifically for something that's fully automated. I think for Robotaxi, I guess my edit would be, I don't think demand, and maybe you meant this too, essentially, but I don't think demand's unlimited. I think there's like roughly 12 trillion miles globally that are traveled today. Like, that could definitely change, and people could decide to take Robotaxis more often because they're more convenient. But yes, I totally agree that the demand far surpasses what we see for human ride hail today. And I feel like even though annual auto sales could change, and maybe you don't need to sell as many cars annually because you're filling more people's needs with single, like, instead of going from using a personal car less than 5% of the time, if you don't have a personal car and you just take robotaxis, if you live in a dense urban center, maybe you don't have to, you know, I think fewer people have to buy cars, but overall, like, it gives, the market is such that Tesla now has so many competitive advantages that I think it can be like a winner takes most scenario in a way that the passenger auto space just is not today.
Can I have one word about that 12 trillion mile?
As many cap? As you want.
Thanks. That cap exists because of the economics of owning a vehicle. But in the third world, the ability to call a robo-taxi at the rates that we're envisaging explodes that capacity by some untold number. I mean, I come from Africa, and I can tell you the taxi business in South Africa is gigantic, and it's with these huge vans and But if you had a robo-taxi opportunity, the demand is some enormous multiple of what it is currently.
It gets weird.
So when you go to India, it changes the whole economics of travel, the whole economics of movement. And so I think it's going to be very difficult to put a cap on the limit of this particular product.
Yeah, I think especially if they can hit that sort of 20, 30 cents, 40 cents per mile and potentially even lower.
Exactly.
You're going from an Uber today, which is, $2 per mile on average. In a lot of urban scenarios is more, especially during peak times. And then you slash that price by 75%. And then all of a sudden now you're like, okay, should I even buy a used car? Should I even carpool to work,
Yeah. Yeah. And that's essentially the point that I'm making, that I think the lower cost does expand the market significantly. And yeah, I agree. It doesn't have to stay at 12 trillion, but there's some capacity limit just given traffic. And I think traffic will improve as autonomy becomes more prolific. I'm just saying there's some upper bound. There's some upper bound by the current infrastructure that we have, because I think it'll work into our current infrastructure.
Yeah, my only point was that upper bound far exceeds the upper bound of supply for, the foreseeable future.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Cool. I think what's interesting about this discussion too, with this more affordable vehicle, and then I want to hit the van real quick and then the bot to wrap up. It's interesting, the timing of this is starting to appear like Tesla's going to unleash a more affordable car, either in the exact look of the cyber cab or some sort of modification that uses the same underpinnings, that's going to make its production rate potentially 50% more in the next 12 to 18 months once they're fully ramped, at the same time that they unleash unsupervised full self-driving on the market in a form factor and a price bracket that is significantly below the average selling price of a car in the United States. I think that is a very unique combination of factors. And to Tasha's point of, winner takes most sort of in the long term, if Tesla is, I used to be in the camp of Tesla doesn't need to advertise this, Tesla doesn't need to market, just let them sell butts in seats. But if they can get to a sub 30,000, 2+2 compact that costs less than 30 grand, and that thing can have unsupervised self-driving, how are they not doing? They should be buying every commercial in the Super Bowl. And every time there's a break in play, it's buy a Tesla, just spend $1 billion. I don't care what the marketing budget is, right? I just think that's a very interesting dynamic they have to execute, obviously. Execution is by far the hardest variable here. So, and it's, I don't want to trivialize it, but okay, let me hit van because we could be talking about this for 10 hours. So, what did the van surprise you? Any thoughts on the van? What are you even envisioning this in your 2029 sort of time frame? Help me understand that a little bit.
We hadn't modeled a van into the model specifically. No, I mean they had, and I know that you all watch these slides as closely as I do. So they had a slide maybe from the investor day where they had cloaked vehicles, and one of them kind of looked like it could be a van, and people thought it was going to look like a Sprinter van, and that's not what it ended up looking like in the end.
A toaster.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's interesting. And actually Larry and I have talked about this previously. So I want, Larry to get his point in on what he thinks the purpose of building this is. Originally my thought was, okay, it's interesting. Okay, they could do cargo in this. So that's a different form factor. They're sort of hitting more parts of the existing vehicle market today. But so many people for ride hail will choose to ride by themselves. And in fact, that's or maybe one other person. And that's why you only need two seats. So it'd be, I think it'll, at least for ride hail, it'll be hard to incentivize people to share. Once it is 40 cents per mile, why do I want to save 10 cents? But yeah, Larry, you should share your kind of
thinking. Yeah, I just suggested that the obvious target for this vehicle was the Boring Company, because this is the ideal form factor for those event situations where you have enormous numbers of people you want to get through the tunnels. But in general, this would really enable the Boring Company to become, you know, a solution in very highly populated areas and so on. So I think it's an ideal solution for the Boring Company. It's what the Boring Company has needed all along. But, you know, since having that conversation, Tasha, I've given it a lot of thought. And I think that the form factor is so interesting because I think it's adaptable to so many different potential use cases. And, you know, it doesn't have to have that seating configuration. It could even be a standing configuration. It could have a very high density seating configuration, can have a very luxury seating configuration, and it can have a variable seating configuration. And there are use cases, a very significant number of use cases for each of those. I just think that we're a lot further away from it than we are from robotaxi and all the others. So I think it's going to be 2 years in the making, or maybe even 3 years, or like the Roadster, 7 years. I don't know, but I think it's going to be a while.
Yeah, I hear those points. Yeah, I still feel like it's a smaller market than robotaxi. And it kind of goes back to what we're saying, like yes. You lower the price per mile, then you expand what current demand is for ride hail so significantly, particularly in countries where, you know, like average income versus car prices is like a much different ratio than the US. So yeah, I think it'll be a smaller market, but I totally agree that it expands use cases. But we'd love to hear your thoughts, Farzad, Hans.
One of the things that immediately struck me about the event was that the version of FSD 13 that they were kind of previewing at the location there at the Warner Brothers studio looked to me to be almost like tailor-made for Boring Company tunnels. Like the point-to-point transport system, just like everything about it really seemed like the first application of that would be Boring Company tunnels. Then the interesting thing about the way that the robo van was designed is how it had those skirts come down so low to the ground all the way around it. And one of the observations that I can't get away from thinking about is that that would be an ideal form factor for a negative pressure fan car like the McMurtry Spearling, which sucks air out from the bottom of the vehicle to create a vacuum to the tarmac. And it allows you to have much, much, much more traction than you would normally have at much higher speeds. And it's almost like the perfect solution to achieve a hyperloop vehicle without evacuating all of the air from the tunnel. You get to an engineering optimization point where you just evacuate the air underneath of your robovan and you can still travel at extremely high speeds with extremely high stability and extremely high control. And that would be an obvious reason why you would not expose the tires to the outside of the vehicle the way that all the other cars are designed currently. And so those two things jump to mind. And then the other thing is that just based on the art that they had inside the RoboVan, they obviously plan to use it in their own service fleet. And so I think that's another application that you can't not mention since they have specifically shown it.
Yeah, I think on the topic of multiple use cases that Larry highlighted, you know, because it's so large, RV, sleeper van, party bus, you know, high density bus, right? To me, it reinforces one of the theories that I've had about this thing long term is this would be like a perfect airline model type product where Tesla becomes a Boeing Airbus type supplier to fleet managers. And then the fleet managers customize the interior to whatever use case they want to customize it to. And then the only place to operate that is on Tesla's robotaxi network. And then, so if you want to hail the party bus to bring your friends from, you know, the suburbs to Center City for $5 for a 20-mile round trip that would traditionally be $150 during peak hours in New York City, right? Y'all just get into this freaking party bus and then you have drinks going down and then you sleep on the way back or whatever, right? Like the use cases become very, very varied in a world where this exists. But at the same time, for that to be a reality, I agree that this is a much more long-term product, where you almost use the cyber cab and the robo taxi network in its current state and in the state for the next 5 years to build the momentum and the sort of a direction for the approval process and the regulatory process to have something like that exist. And then long term, that is the product that comes to mind. It's like, okay, so now Tesla's just going to supply. I don't care about spending any time with the interior. It minimizes the complexity of the manufacturing process, and I still make a bunch of money on the back end, because the only way to operate that is on my robotaxi network, which by then is going to be, my theory would be, the dominant point-to-point transportation ride-hail service, sort of outstripping Uber and Lyft and all those guys long term. So, but I don't see it coming to fruition not until the 2030s, to be completely honest.
Yeah, if they really want to own the autonomous cargo space, and they're already going after cargo with a semi, we haven't seen, although there are companies tackling, yes, like the class 8 trucks, class 7 and below, I haven't seen any like real autonomy players in the van space. So in a way, it's smart to go after that particular. And then, there'll be I think there'll be smaller robots, there'll be drones delivering packages too, but owning what vehicles own today, it's not a bad idea to look at that.
Which brings us really to Optimus, right? Because if you're going to be in that space, having Optimus robots to do that last 50 yards of the delivery, Optimus is what will do that for you.
For sure. What was your takeaway on Optimus? That was like one of the coolest things I've ever seen, even though they appear to be teleoperated in a lot of different use cases. What Hans and I were talking about on Friday was like, there's still incredible potential to have a fleet of teleoperated robots where you can have leverage on human labor 5-to-1, right? So you have one human overseeing 5 robots. And then when the robot sort of throws a failure mode, the human gets in and fixes it. I don't know if you can hear my 4-month-old in the background. He's teething. And it's a nightmare, poor guy. So anyway, go for it. What thoughts do you have there, Tasha?
Yes, on the humanoid, I do feel like the reaction to teleops is kind of overblown. We see successful teleop operations today, particularly with heavy machinery. You know, like that's the mining first. It's not quite fully autonomous. There still is teleops in a lot of operations and in industries that like do not have a Tesla kind of going for that whole hog solution. It seems it does reduce the amount of labor you need, particularly on-site labor, which like can be undesirable for workers to do the traveling, et cetera, from job sites, depending on what you're working on. So I totally agree with that takeaway. I think the solution that they're aiming for is way more generalized and will be much more impressive than what we saw at the event. But it's like, and we talk about this so much internally, like, there's application specific, and then there's so much that you could do with a humanoid form factor if you really do get Gen AI right. And it's just, there's so much that we don't know along the way that I think getting to market first, or at least one of the first players, is a smart thing to do, just to learn the landscape. And in fact, that's how teleops so far has been used, to just get something on the road or on whatever operation you've done so far. So
does that change y'all's sort of how you're thinking about the bot long term? Or have you always had that theory where they would start with some sort of teleoperated sort of approach, and then long term they'll go generalized? How has that changed at all?
Well, I guess it's still not clear to me that they, and I'd be curious to get your thoughts. It's like, it's still possible that they won't start with teleoperated. It's just what they're doing now to demonstrate ability. I guess in a sense they're starting with it, but what I'm thinking is like, what they say that they're going to use in their own factory, is that necessarily going to be teleoperated when they're really trying to do that at scale? My original assumption was no, although maybe pieces of it could be. Right. So, right now in the model that we have published online, we have extremely conservative assumptions on Optimus. So it has very little impact on our price target. Although long term, Based on the work that my colleague Sam Corris has done, we think it's a $24 trillion opportunity between manufacturing and home robots. So a lot of headway there. It hasn't changed too much about that long-term picture, but yeah, do you all think that it will be teleoperated when they first install it in the factory? What are your thoughts?
To me, it seems like it's Tesla's playbook to release products that improve over time with data they gather from their customer base. And if they already have a way to teleoperate a human or robot, that to me seems like the process that they'll use to gather data from the real world, from real customers. Exactly the same thing that they're doing with their cars. Why does FSD 12.5 or 0.6 or version 13 exist? Because Tesla customers since 2015, 2016 have been feeding data to Tesla's AI brain to make it be that. So the way I think about this is for the foreseeable future, 5, 6, 8 years, because the last thing you want is start selling these to families, to their home, and this thing falls on a newborn. And it's like the worst possible, like you do not want that, right? That has to be like deleted from existence. And that's going to take a lot of time to get there. But I think they'll start using it internally. They'll use the teleoperated inputs to correct for failures. They'll automate a lot of the processes through that, end-to-end neural network. The robot will say, I need help. And then somebody, from Tesla that is maybe in charge of 5 or 10 robots or whatever, they'll correct it. And then they'll use that as an exception-based data gathering tool. Then once they're like, okay, we're comfortable that this thing can work in a general assembly line, at least for us, we'll prototype these with customers. Maybe you give them 10 free. Be like, hey, Amazon or GM, would y'all like to use 10 of our robots? We'll give you the robots for free and you can use them for your use cases. They'll probably sell it. I mean, we all know they're going to sell it. But even if they don't sell it, that data gathering process they would now have with the teleoperation can be used to improve every single human or robot moving forward. And then you expand your customer base more and more and more and more to the point where you're like, okay, I'm now comfortable using this as a delivery bot from the car to the front door. Okay, now we can use it in a landscape area. They can help you, maybe like plant trees or whatever, right? And then the use cases sort of like exponentially get greater and greater as a data gathering process that they're leveraging makes the bot smarter. Yeah. That's how I view it.
You're on mute still, Larry.
You're still excited about the Starship.
Oh. Well, Larry.
Yeah, sorry. I don't think the domestic bot market is going to be the focus for a long time. I think it's going to be at the back end of the adoption. When I modeled this out, when I modeled out the bot business, I modeled out about 4 or 5 bots per human support person. And I think that's where we're going to be in the middle course. In the beginning, it'll be 1 and 1, but in the middle course, it'll probably be 1 and 5. And it's so economic that 1 and 5 works extremely well. Any greater than that, it's just ridiculous. So it's going to be the dangerous, the dirty, the kind of jobs that people don't want to do. As you said, Tasha, mining is an excellent example. And any other, the oil industry, I think there's just so many applications for which value add is so much higher than the domestic one. And it's far less, the ability of business of an industry to support these bots are much greater than the homeowner's ability to support them and so on and so forth. But the economics are very compelling. Even at 1 to 3, they're better than break even. At 1 to 5, they're amazingly profitable. Anything above that gets really good. And, the cost of production of these things are going to be very, very low, ultimately. And they may be very high right now. I think the bill of materials for some of these firms I've looked at, in the hundreds of thousands right now, but they'll be down to 20,000. They'll be down to the kind of numbers that we've been looking at. So I think that human support, right up to teleoperation, is fine in the early years. And I think that's exactly as Fawzad said. We're training the cars. We'll be training the bots for a while to come. That's how I think about it.
Yeah, certainly like in training, just putting sensors on a human to show the robot what to do. And then I agree. I think autonomy will roll out the same way, that there'll be a remote operator. And that's how other companies have done it. Elon mentioned it would be like an RC car at one point. So certainly it's like a fail-safe solution. I agree. That makes sense.
Hans, did you want to throw anything in before we wrap this sucker up? We got to let Pasha get back.
No, y'all did a great job of capturing all the points. There wasn't anything that I had really to add there. You know, like Tesla's not going to throw them on the line in a situation where a person has to actually teleoperate it 100%. Like you put it on the line once it can do a bunch of the tasks automatically. And then, like you both said, then you have a teleoperator who's there to handle the errors and, you know, fix it when things go wrong, which they will. You don't put it on the line and just have it do work. You would do what Tasha was mentioning. If the point is to gather data about how to do the work from operating, well, then you just have a person sit there and do the work, and you have a sensor rig to capture the data from how they do it, but they don't actually teleoperate a robot do it. They just do it. So. Yeah, all the points there, I fully agree with.
Yeah. I think one of the most interesting things about Tesla right now is that if you think about their product line, they're shifting into this sort of value proposition that is shifting away from sustainable transport, super cool cars, best bang for your buck, to our products will give you back time, right? Unsupervised FSD makes... The most valuable thing from that product is obviously safety, but the second one is that now you can do whatever you want. You know, time being the most valuable right. currency out there, and then the bot takes that to just a ridiculous level. I mean, like the end product of this bot, where it can fold clothes, which again is the literal worst thing ever invented by humans, is folding clothes. Once this thing can do that, then it's like now you've opened up a whole can of worms, and I say that in a good way or a bad way, because then you're talking about, okay, so you know, the long debate of what do we do if we have infinite time as human beings, right? So I view that as very interesting. And as a forcing function for Tesla's success long term, if you look at all different business cases, the ones that seem to be most successful, most valuable, are the ones that give the customer back time. And I think that's just a fascinating, fascinating transition. Tasha, I'll give you the last word and let people know where people can find you and ARK Invest before we wrap this sucker up.
Oh, thank you. Well, I just want to say, I think you all make fantastic points. And yeah, I agree that certainly at like higher price points, you see it going into industrial applications first. But then the nice thing about the consumer market is it like really, from a volume perspective, if it's cheap enough, it could be a really big opportunity, but totally agree that it could come later. Thank you all so much for having me today. So I'm on Twitter, Tasha Ark. You can see my handle here, but I encourage everyone to follow everyone from the ARK Invest team. Check out our research, ark-invest.com. We're always talking about Tesla, and we actually always want to hear other points of view. So thanks so much for sharing with me today from you all. But anyone that's listening, I want to hear your point of view.
Awesome. Thank you. Bye, everybody. Bye-bye. All right. I'm going to end recording.
Take care. Here. Good to see you three.